You probably know the hits. Hits?
Those guys?
You probably know the hits.
Hey, sports fans. This is You Probably Know the Hits. I'm Jason. That's Jeremy. Who are we going to talk about today, Jeremy?
We are going to talk about a little band that I'd say 3 weeks ago I would not have envisioned we would ever really talk about. And that band is The Grateful Dead.
Can we talk about the road to The Grateful Dead for you? Because it seems like it's like a life-altering path. Who was it? Is it Fish? Who did this to you?
Who is what was my gateway drug?
Yeah. LSD, obviously. But
well, we have to go, you know, my biggest dive into jam bands has been pretty recent, and that's with a newer band called Goose.
Okay.
And so, you know, Goose is a modern jam band. I love them. They're great. I cannot wait to see them live. But I have always been kind of jam band averse.
Right.
I never got it. I think me and you would probably make fun of it most of the time.
Oh, yeah.
If we ever talked about it.
Still in that boat, just to be clear.
I was making the joke at the Dead show. Like, so it was the first half just like two songs.
Right.
That are like 35 minutes each.
Yeah.
And when they first hit the stage and they were just like tuning, I was like, is this the first song?
Yeah, right. Oh, this is nice. It sounds better than I thought, guys.
Oh, man. So,
from this Goose band to Grateful Dead inside of a month, is that right?
Yeah, well, no. Goose has been a couple of months for me.
Okay.
I'm a couple
but
of months
still,
in.
I mean, that's a compressed timeline. Is it safe to say that this is a midlife crisis? Is that a fair?
No, sir.
No.
No.
I feel like jam bands in 2023 is a midlife crisis. That's probably up there on the top 10, you know?
I mean, did I also recently buy a convertible? Okay. Don't ask me about my earring. We don't need to talk about it. Have I taken up smoking meats? I guess.
These are all just random coincidences, though. Right?
I'm going to tell you, my interest level in the Dead for real was like basically zero.
Yeah.
I had a few songs that I really liked,
sure,
and they were coming to Dallas. It is their quote farewell tour, and I buy it that it's the farewell of this incarnation of the Dead.
Okay,
and so I have a couple of Deadhead friends who don't know each other, but I know both of them. Because I'm very popular, and you know, they both were like, yeah, you should check it out.
Okay.
And so I just got a lawn ticket. It was at, you know, Starplex in Dallas. I just got a lawn ticket, met up with my friends on the lawn, and actually the experience really started when I got to the parking lot at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We will go through all of this because it is the wildest scene I have ever been a part of. And I've done some shit, my friend. Let me tell you, okay?
Okay,
but
listen,
was like nothing I've ever experienced in my life.
Question. All these bands, you know, they go on and there's like in all of these cities, there's basically an 11 o'clock, you know, sound curfew, right? And I'm not sure if Dallas is any different, but every city I've lived in has had this. So if the band's got a 1 hour set, you know, the headliner, then you can pretty much be guaranteed they're going on at like 9:30. You know, if they got a 2 hour set, like I saw The Cure recently, those motherfuckers going on at like 8 o'clock, 8:15, because they at 11 there was a fucking law that per minute is going to cost them a lot of fucking money.
Mm-hmm.
So does the Dead take the stage at 10 o'clock in the morning?
You know what? I am not joking when I say it was literally like 7:30.
Oh my god.
I mean, it was, and it's I saw that same Cure show that you saw at the same venue that I saw the Dead at.
I couldn't believe it was 2.5 hours. I really couldn't.
The Cure started at 8 o'clock, like on the dot,
right?
And it was broad daylight.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I don't think I've been to a show that started like that, or like I've seen the openers start in the daylight like that, but I've never been there where the headliner went on, and it looks like you know how all the concerts in Europe always look like during the daytime?
Yeah.
I don't know if the sun doesn't set there.
Even have lights? Who cares?
I don't know if the sun doesn't set there until like 11 p.m. I don't know what's going on over there.
Right.
But that's what it looked like. I mean, you're just like, the lights don't even matter.
Yeah.
You can hear fine. It's all good.
Here's the deal. That Cure show was like, the set list was 20, 22, 23 songs deep. They're all 2 and 3 and, you know, maybe a couple of them are 5 or 6 minute songs, maybe. But like this Grateful Dead one, you're saying it started at 7:30, so it's probably a 3.5 hour set. How many songs?
Oh, I could look it up, but probably 18.
Man.
And we're talking, they played from like 7:30 to, I mean, it was after 11.
Yeah, 11:30 or something, whenever the cutoff date is.
I mean, and there's a long intermission.
Yeah.
But it's not like, so they went off for intermission. And I was like, so what, we got like 15 minutes? And my deadhead friend was like, no, this is going to be like 45 minutes.
In the middle. And I said, interesting.
I said, why? Why so long? And she goes, she goes, this is when you take your second dose. She goes, that's literally why it's so long. So people can dose up and like, it hits by the time the second step, you know.
Interesting. So that's not different than the Cure show then. That's the same amount of time. You take that 45 minutes out. That's exactly when the Cure went on. That's exactly. So you got a 2.5 hour set. I've heard of Pearl Jam doing literally 3.5 hours without much of an intermission at all. That's pretty fucking brutal. No matter how much you're into a band, that's it's a lot of entertainment.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
So we're going to come back to the show.
Let's talk about the Grateful Dead. I know almost nothing about them. My father is a huge, huge fan. Might be super shocking. He had long hair in the 70s. He was into other bands such as Pink Floyd. One can guess as to how he would find the Grateful Dead soothing and, Far Out Man. But despite that, I don't really know a ton about them. He's played, played some records for me over time, and it's just kind of like, to me, like, I don't know. And maybe music has built on these guys, and that's why it doesn't sound particularly, different than anything, I guess. But to me, it just sounds like Americana sort of feel good late 60s music.
Some of it is.
Okay.
And some of what you hear there is like the song Ripple. Uh-huh. Which is, sounds like just a hippie song, right? It just sounds like a fun, you know. They did make a couple of albums in the early 70s that were a little bit more country based.
Okay.
Where the songs had a little bit more shape to them than some of their other stuff.
American Beauty, one of those? Because that's the one I've heard was like the huge.
Man, okay. American Beauty
is it the most accessible, basically?
Extremely accessible. So good. It is so good. Mm-hmm. It is an excellent listen. Highly recommend.
Okay.
What kind of music is this?
Is this like, Sunday morning chores, sweeping the floor? Or is this like you're sitting down with the whiskey in the dark, ruminating about that midlife crisis?
More weed than whiskey, for sure.
More weed than whiskey.
Perhaps something a little psychedelic. Perhaps something a little bit more psychedelic than that,
in fact. Sandwiched between a couple of Willie albums.
I mean, you are literally going to just chill out. And I'll tell you what people do at the shows.
Uh-huh.
They literally just dance. And I'm not kidding when I say people are, they're not just kind of bobbing up and down with the music. Like, men and women alike are just full on dancing.
Really?
In the lawn, in their seats, in the pit. Like, they just vibe.
The entire time?
I mean, people, yes.
Not just the three big fucking songs.
No. They are standing up and just vibing, like, the entire show. And I am not joking when I say it's the only show I've been to where I'm like, literally the majority of people here are on something.
Oh, yeah. That's crazy.
I mean, the majority. And I saw there was
Except
a lot of weed.
For
there was
that
a
Led Zeppelin thing we saw in 98 with Page and Plant. Okay.
Yeah. We're like, there was a 14-year-old next to me getting high.
Right. Exactly.
No, but this is like, there was a lot of weed at The Cure, but at The Dead, I've never really seen anything like what I saw there.
Exactly.
It was a quiet bit. And so I would almost call it acid rock, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
So I'm not going to go through the chronological, Dead story, because I don't know it well enough to do that.
Sure.
I've been a Dead fan for like 2 weeks, and it's basically
much an expert. I mean, do you have Wikipedia in front of you? continue? Because that's really all we need to do as a podcast.
It's basic. Yeah. Being a deadhead now is like my entire, deadhead. I'm a deadhead. Yeah. It's like my entire personality now. It's all I talk about. I say things like,
have you redone your office? You've got the rainbow tie-dye flags and they got the dancing bear on them, all that everywhere around. Or
yeah, well, did you see the shirt I wore to the show?
I did not.
I had a tie-dye tank top. It was beautiful, man.
That's awesome.
So that I bought in the parking lot of the show.
Nice.
It was awesome. But here's what would happen. So when the band got together, so Jerry Garcia, you're familiar with Jerry Garcia.
Right.
A little bit, right?
Right.
Big teddy bear looking man.
Right.
And when you look at interviews with him, and basically most of my source material here is coming from two places. There's a book I'm reading right now called Long Strange Trip.
Okay.
Story of the Dead.
Okay.
And it is very in-depth. I'm like 9 hours in and I'm like to like 1964 or something. Oh, like where they're not even a band yet.
When did they? Oh, okay. All right.
So, and then I watched a documentary on Amazon Prime called Long Strange Trip. It is a very accessible documentary and it is so, so good. And if you're just a fan of music in general, you should watch it.
Okay.
It is so great.
Sure.
Jerry Garcia is he's a kid growing up in the valley, like San Francisco.
Okay.
Not wealthy or anything. His parents were like immigrants from Spain.
Okay.
And, but he's pretty well read. He's a smart kid. He has dalliances with a few instruments, but he's very musical, like kind of right away. He gets really into bluegrass music. He gets way into like the banjo.
Okay.
And he said he loved it. And I've never heard it described like this, but he's really right. When he said the banjo is a very like thunderous instrument. It is an aggressive, loud, thunderous instrument. And he loved it. Huh. A lot more than the singer-songwriter types, you know, that he was hearing, like, with an acoustic guitar.
Right. And what era is this? This is like, just before the Beatles, like, early 60s.
Yeah, this is, okay.
So he doesn't have, like, Hendrix floating around.
No. Okay. The Beatles were not even on the scene.
And, I mean, yeah, you think about the very early Beatles, when they first came out, the guitar was, like, a super wimpy thing at that point, right?
In the very beginning.
Chuck Berry was before that, right?
Yeah, Chuck Berry was before then. The Beatles had more of a driving beat, though, than those bands. And you hear, like, I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Right.
That really doesn't sound like anything else that was happening in 1963.
Right.
But Jerry,
Twist and Shout kind of had a guitar to it.
But they didn't write that.
I know. I was just saying, in terms of a thunderous instrument, I mean, he's talking 10 years before that even happened for guitars.
Sure.
Like, right?
Sure. And, I mean, think about how loud. Have you ever heard a banjo, like, up close? Like,
oh, yeah.
It's a very loud instrument.
100% up close, way very thunderous.
Yeah. So he gets really into it. He loves it. Big fan of bluegrass. He learns bluegrass. He learns banjo, acoustic guitar. He loves it, and he's got like a bluegrass band. And as he gets into adulthood, he is he gets married. He has a child, and he starts to realize it's kind of hard to make a living on bluegrass in San Francisco.
Okay.
There's just not much demand for bluegrass. So he thinks about giving up on it and either switching genres or just going and getting a job or whatever. He takes a trip through the South because he wanted to go see if maybe he could make it as a bluegrass artist in the South where there'd be more of a demand for it. He'd never been to the South before. This is a kid who grew up in San Francisco.
Right.
And he goes down there and like he sees like colored bathrooms.
Credence story. Where it's like, I was sure Creedence is like from Louisiana or something, right? And it's like an affectation.
They're from Bakersfield.
Yeah, exactly.
Basically.
Yeah.
El Cerrito, to be exact.
Right, yeah. Okay, so he goes down there. Does he grab
horrified.
A band down there, or he just kind of goes there to check it out?
He kind of checks it out. He's horrified.
Okay,
like,
right.
He cannot believe the racism. Like, he's never seen anything like this in San Francisco.
Right.
And he's like totally disillusioned by the whole thing, and he goes home. He knows he cannot be a bluegrass player anymore because he can't make it in California. He can't move to the South.
Yep.
That has a real impact on him.
Okay.
We're just going to kind of skip way ahead. He and a guy named Bob Weir.
Okay. I've heard that guy's name. Okay.
Yeah, Bob Weir is a member of the Grateful Dead. He is still in the Dead and Company. They become friends. There's a bass player named Phil Lesh, who's a really intelligent, really well-read guy. They basically decide to form kind of an R&B band. And they kind of share an interest in the same style of music. And so they start doing a lot of covers, a lot of blues covers, and kind of fancy themselves kind of like a Rolling Stones type band, where they want to be like really bluesy, really loose, you know, really fun. Mostly covers, but then they start writing their own songs. Everything changes when they do LSD for the first time. Now, you and me talked ad nauseum about Pink Floyd.
Right.
And how they had, we kind of thought, an unearned reputation as a drug band.
Right. Definitely unearned,
In reality, they really weren't way into drugs. You know, not any more than any other.
Three quarters of the original band that seems like maybe weren't.
there was one that was really into them.
Primarily the main guy who basically made Pink Floyd and was Pink Floyd for all intents and purposes until he burned down so badly they had to kick him out, right?
Right. So they start doing LSD, and they start hanging out together on LSD. Not writing music, not playing music, but they start just hanging out together, and they just love it. I mean, they like fall in love with this drug.
Right.
And they would do it like every day. And they would do LSD, they'd go out to the beach, and then at night the LSD would wear off and they would rehearse and they would play.
Okay.
And like they just fell into this lifestyle that they loved. Well, then at some point they start incorporating it into the music. And they started doing LSD like while they played.
Okay.
Like first just like rehearsing.
Right, right.
And they loved it. Because the music just started going any which direction.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, okay.
I mean, they thought they really tapped into something, and they had.
Right.
And so, but then they start doing these things called acid tests.
Okay.
Which is, they would have full-on LSD performances, and it would be like even the crowd had LSD, and they would do just these big LSD parties.
Huh.
Where they would play.
And this is back when it was like brand new and legal. This is part of the reason that the Pink Floyd thing had a problem, right? Was that nobody, it wasn't a, you know, Schedule One or whatever drug. It was something that was new and exciting and seemed like a breakthrough for, psychological applications and such, you know.
And it was being, you know, like they had a friend like who was making it. I mean, they like really high quality stuff.
Right.
And so, so they start doing these acid tests that just turn, they're these kind of legendary performances where, and I think it has its own Wikipedia page, like Grateful Dead acid tests, if I'm not mistaken.
Sure.
But they would drop acid and just play. And like they said, there was one show where like, the bridge on Jerry's guitar broke and the strings like were coiled up on the neck and Jerry was like playing nothing and like didn't notice. But they said that was the whole point of the acid test is you weren't supposed to correct anything. Like if somebody went in one direction, you go in that direction and you just play. And that like it they gained kind of a following doing this.
Right. This sounds a lot like that. What was that place that Pink Floyd played in?
UFO Club.
Yeah, exactly. Where it was like a, you know, I think Pink Floyd maybe had a little bit more structure to it, maybe. But yeah, like just kind of like it's a scene, right?
It's a scene.
Is it a scene that's just wrapped completely around these guys, or is it like there's some other bands kind of involved? You know, this is a weekly. You know,
there are some like the Jefferson Airplane was around at the time.
Okay.
So they're one of them. There were a couple of other artists. I don't remember exactly who, but the Airplane is one that they've mentioned a few times. Was kind of in that circle.
Makes a lot of sense. Okay.
Yeah, for sure. David Crosby was around, I believe.
Okay.
So they're doing their thing, and they're loving it, and they're gaining kind of a following doing this. Some shows are disasters,
right?
But it doesn't matter. Like everyone is just in on it. It's like everyone's in on the joke,
right?
And at some point, they do gain a little bit of traction with a couple of radio songs. Some stuff that you've probably heard, like Casey Jones, Truckin', Uncle John's Band. Like, those got a little bit of radio play.
Okay.
But their shows are everything. They put everything into the shows. And what happened when they did LSD was they started like not thinking about music in terms of having like a beginning and an end, and just, you know, take away the structure that you would normally have to it, and it can go anywhere.
Right.
And as they're doing that, it catches on in kind of a significant way, to where, because their shows were all so unique, people would go to multiple shows. So if I'm a guy here in Dallas and I'm going to buy one ticket to see their show, you know, that's it. They get my $50 and I see the show.
Right.
But if I'm going to follow them around, they're going to get my $50 like 8 times.
Okay. This is the proverbial deadhead. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
This is where people start going to multiple shows, because every show is just totally different. They back then, they said, Jerry Garcia said, we don't even have a set list when we go out on stage. We don't write anything down. We have no plan. We just go out there and play. And so someone they'd noodle around, and then someone would start something, right, and they'd play.
This is white people jazz.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's such a white person thing.
Yeah. It really does sound like it. Yeah. Okay.
So they gain, and I'm not doing the chronological thing because I don't know enough about it, but they gain a massive, massive, loyal, very loyal following largely due to the complete uniqueness of every single performance.
Right.
You did not know what they were going to play. And even if they played a song you love, you don't know what it's going to sound like.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And, What's also happening?
There's so many, like hundreds and hundreds of bootlegs. They're one of the most bootlegged bands of all time.
Well,
it's like, you know, you think about that, and like Pearl Jam is also heavily bootlegged. And it's like, I mean, Pearl Jam is notable for changing their set list up almost every night. But at the same time, there's still, you know, a catalog of 100 songs, and it's always going to be Even Flow. When they play Even Flow, it's going to sound like Even Flow, right?
Right.
And it's just
right.
Like, I don't, you know, I get it from a completionist standpoint, but that's crazy that show to show could be wildly different 2 or 3 nights later, you know?
And what's crazy is the Deadheads, they know all these performances. So like this has happened to me.
Okay.
So there's a song that I really have fallen in love with called Jack Straw.
Okay.
And, but there are 1,000 versions of it. If you search Jack Straw on Spotify, there's 1,000 of them.
Crazy.
I mean, because from all the live performances they have out. And so I asked, texted a friend of mine who's a Deadhead. I said, hey, what's the best Jack Straw version? He texts back 2 seconds later, and it's like, October 24th, 1974, Syracuse.
What?
Like right away.
And then he's got like 3 exactly. other suggestions as well, right? And then,
okay.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Last night, I'm at a concert last night up in Tulsa.
Sure.
And I'm talking to a guy who's a Deadhead.
Okay.
And I tell him that story about how my friend, when I said, what's the best version of Jack Straw? And when I said that, that guy blurted out, like, September 20th, 1986, Chicago.
Man, I get it. The some of the Pumpkins people, I've seen that on the Reddit for the Pumpkins. There was like a thread a little while ago. This dude who was trying to listen, there's a song called Silver Fuck that's like their kind of a jam thing, like you're talking about, where like it's originally like an 8-minute song, and they will, you know, just kind of space out in the last bit of it and make it a 12-minute or a 13-minute. And there's this guy, the Internet Archive has tons and tons of bootlegs of the Pumpkins. He was methodically making his way through it, and people had really strong opinions on like, well, make sure you don't miss this one specifically. And it's like, oh, were you at that show? He's like, no, it wasn't at the show. It's just the best one of all time. You're like, okay, all right. You know, like, I mean, to me, that sounds like, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the band. That sounds like torture, trying to listen to literally like 400 versions of the same song. And there are people out there, more than one, you know. Deadhead sounds like that's nuts to me. The people have, and if you ask them another song, they're not going to just pull it all from the Chicago show, right? They're like,
right,
for one of the 50 songs you could ask them, they would have totally different shows, and it just memorized. It's nuts.
And by the way, this is exactly what, like, another, you know, one of my new favorite bands, Goose, that's exactly what they do. Like, their performances, they'll just show up on Spotify. Like, you know, their performance from 2 weeks ago will just show up on Spotify.
Man.
And they're just, so there's like, you know, Goose has like, you know, 15 live albums out there that crazy. You can listen to.
And that's from this tour. And, they've only
been around for a few years.
Man.
But every one of theirs, and people on the Goose, like, you know, Reddit forums are like, dude, Hunger Sight from Cincinnati is straight fire, man. Like, you know, they're just like they, and people will say, no, man, my favorite is Pancakes from Salt Lake City. And like, it's insane.
Right.
Like, it's the dedication these people have to it. But I kind of get it. I'll get to why I get it here in a minute.
Like, this is 60 fucking years later that it's still. Mm-hmm. This level, and like your friend that you're talking to was our age, right? Early mid 40s, not somebody who is 80 years old.
Yeah, no, yeah. This is someone who's like the guy yesterday was like my age or younger.
Man,
and my other friend who's a deadhead, he's only a few years older than me.
Huh.
And but you know, he's been going to shows since he said like 1980, I think.
Okay, let me put it to you this way: your average LSD user. Pink Floyd is the obvious. Is Grateful Dead a sophistication thing? You're well-traveled LSD user?
No. Okay. The Dead is you must have a willingness to let go.
Okay.
You must have a willingness to just be able to completely let go and just kind of let the music absorb within you.
Huh. Okay. That's a concept. Okay.
Yeah.
So the comfortably numb solo. The entire, that's the entire feeling the whole time.
That boy, what a great way to put it.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Except for the songs you sent me sound nothing like the fucking comfortably numb solo.
Yeah. I wouldn't equate the music. I would just equate the feeling. Okay. I want to separate the two.
Right. Right.
Cause there's no, here's the other funny thing that they did at the time though. All those live performances, they would allow bootleggers to come in early and set up.
Right. Okay.
Like, they didn't stop bootleggers.
Right.
They said, Bob Weir said, it was just the easiest thing to do rather than fight them and try to stop it from happening.
I'm sure we're going to cover this, but I was looking at that Wall of Sound thing, which is something my dad mentioned to me that has always piqued my interest. And it was like 73, which you haven't really established like when they started and like what the timeline here is. But it said like just, you know, just a little factoid drop in the top of the article about that particular sound setup was that they're regularly bringing in 100,000 people every single show, which is out of fucking control. That's bigger than stadium size all of the time. So that's just $500,000 in 1960X every 2 days, every 3 days. I think they're fine, right?
They're making a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
The demand for their shows actually starts to cause problems. I'll tell you about that here in just a second.
Maybe not $500,000, my bad, because it's not a $50 ticket back then. But anyway,
right. So, but still, a significant amount of money.
Yeah, the equivalent to $500,000 today. Yeah.
So yeah, they allowed bootleggers to come in early and set up their taping systems.
Okay.
They had a specific spot.
And they'd be like, seen these rigs? It's like a guy with practically a fucking reel to reel. It's barely portable. It's like for like a journalist. I mean,
especially a
labor of love. Completely. Anyway, yeah.
I mean, they get a lot of credit for this.
Sure.
And I don't know why they did it, but it sounds like they just didn't want to mess with it.
Yeah.
There's a real interesting part of the book that I'm reading where they take a chapter off from the chronological stuff and it skips ahead to, it starts out by saying, and this is the late 1980s when he's writing this. And it just says there is a corporation based in San Francisco. They have significant amounts of office space. They have monthly board meetings consisting of, you know, 15 board members. They have a 401k. They have a pension. Yada yada yada, and it's a Grateful Dead board meeting.
What the?
And heck? it's like Phil Lesh, the bass player, is the chairman of the board.
How long has this existed? Since like the 90s or something, or since the band existed, or
I don't know. But basically the point is like the Grateful Dead is a massive multi-million dollar corporation.
Yeah, I mean, so is Metallica, right? I mean,
but exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And they go through this board meeting, and they so there's this is the monthly board meeting, and so they basically this chapter is the reading of the minutes of the board meeting.
Man,
and it's fascinating. Now they obviously it's very redacted, it's very paraphrased, so right. They don't get into like specific numbers. But one of the it's like the Phil Lesh running the meeting is like, all right, item number one. Some of the venues are asking us to move the tapers to another part of the arena because, you know, fans are complaining that they're not getting, you know, able to stand there.
Okay.
And, you know, so.
Man.
And so they talk about where, you know, well, we can move them just to the left of the soundboard, you know, but then the sound's not going to be as good. And like, they're really worried about that. That
man,
the sound
that's
is
crazy. It's not just, they don't want to mess with it. They're like, it's like a part of the culture. Yeah.
Huh. And then they're like, well, do we want to just stop it altogether and just start, you know, because they said like someone is like, you know, in every performance clause, it says we're not to allow taping, but, you know,
sure,
we always have.
Right.
And so it doesn't tell you how it ends, but it does mention a couple of other things that I thought were really interesting. And one of them is that is the crowd size thing. So it's like item number four, fall tour. And who the tour coordinator starts talking and he's like, so we've got 2 weeks through the South and then we've got 2 weeks, you know, then we got a week off and then we have 2 weeks through the Northeast in November. And he said, we're having problems with the venues in the Northeast. Like we've been thrown out of a few because what was happening is the party scene in the parking lot had grown so large that people who didn't have tickets to the show were coming to party.
They would just breach and just run right in and rush it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The parking lots were getting overrun with people. There'd be as many people in the parking lot during the show as are in the show.
Whoa. Okay.
And so they mentioned like, I think like the Carrier Dome in Syracuse, they're like, we've been thrown out of there because of the crowds, they can't handle the demand.
Right.
And so they said, it's like someone like Jerry Garcia or someone was like, well, what if we not do any more in the South for a while and let's just double up on what we do in the Northeast and try to get it to where these shows are not sold out.
Hmm.
And I'm like, I've never heard an artist say something like
that.
Yeah,
right.
Like, I want to get the demand down. Like, let's play so right. much.
Right.
Let's play so much that we're not
that
selling shows
out. That everybody can
have a seat. Yes.
Man.
Like, let's get it to where we're not quite selling these shows out and then we'll stop.
Damn.
And like, I thought that was really interesting, just to hear the thought process on it. Cause it was a problem for them. It was a real problem for them.
Like
venues did not.
Man, that's crazy. Compared to, you know, Pink Floyd famously doing, you know, 10 shows a tour and being pissed off at the fans, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, different era, different, like, you know, a decade later or whatever, but yeah.
No. And it does come back to bite them.
Okay.
The nonstop touring.
Sure.
You know, people will always say that's what killed
earlier,
Jerry.
Like 64-ish, 65. When do they kind of?
They form as
release a record, but like yeah, whenever they start to get the following.
They start to get the following in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s.
Okay.
They played Woodstock.
Okay.
John Fogerty hated the Grateful Dead for years because the Grateful Dead played right before CCR and Fogerty said everyone was asleep by the time we went out there.
Yeah, right.
Like the Dead put everyone to sleep with their acid rock.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Interesting.
So that's the time frame. And so, but the following gets huge. In the late 70s, the following does turn into a problem. Like number one, they're getting overrun with people. Number two,
I mean, you're talking about late 70s. This is, you know, Woodstock was 69, right?
What about 69?
Woodstock was 69.
Oh, Woodstock was 69, yeah.
Okay, so they already have enough of a following to be in Woodstock, right? Obviously, and maybe it's huge at that point. Like a fucking decade later, and this is nonstop touring?
Well, not everyone at Woodstock was huge.
Okay, sure.
There were some bands that were still a little bit unknown.
Okay,
but,
beside the point. Like you said, you mentioned early 70s. Like, so they're do they go nonstop for 10 years or they take a few years off in the middle?
No, they do. I think they take a short break in the mid 70s, maybe like a year or so.
Okay.
And then they come back and it was relatively nonstop after that.
And they this following is just every time they show up, there people are just insane amount of people are there.
More and more every time.
What the fuck?
And again, I had never thought about the genius of changing up your set every night.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's not even about changing up your set. I mean, for the Dead, it's way more than that.
Yeah, it's the feeling. It's the community, right?
It's just the vibe of the song. And that's a really unique thing. But also, yeah, I'm going to follow you around and go to as many shows as I can because I know the next one's going to be totally different and awesome.
That's true. Yeah.
And, you know, why would I go see The Cure a second time? It's going to be the exact same show.
Exactly.
The exact same set list.
Maybe three songs, right?
Right.
Not
enough where I'd care to go to multiple shows.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So this scene. So what was happening in the parking lot is this. They have this thing.
This is when you came to the show you went to, or talk about even back then?
No, this is what has been happening since back then.
Okay.
They have this thing called Shakedown Street.
Okay.
Shakedown Street is this area in the parking lot full of vendors. So they have kind of the traditional, you know, tents that you'll see in that type of situation.
Some hot dogs and cotton candy kind of shit.
And art, yep. T-shirts,
okay.
Drugs, alcohol.
Okay.
Literally anything.
Nice day in downtown Portland so far.
Dude, it's wild. Like there was literally, so as soon as I get there, my buddy who's a Deadhead, you know, he finds me and he's like, "All right, let's go to Shakedown Street." I'm like, I didn't even know what this was.
Yeah.
I had no idea what this was.
Oh, great. So we walked down, back alley somewhere.
So we walk down there and it's like a carnival. Like there's this guy over here is on a Blackstone grilling hamburgers, okay. Selling them for $1 a piece. Here's a full bar. Here's a lady with some gym.
Let's just plant that in the ground. Dollar
hamburger. Here's a lady with some Jim Beam and some vodka, and she's selling shots for $3. Here's a guy with a sign.
Did you check out her liquor license?
I did not, nor I don't think the city did either. There was a guy literally with a sign that said, like, pre-rolled THC, $8, mushrooms, $25. I mean, just right there. Just
okay, so, again, Dallas, Texas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where are the cops?
Not there. I couldn't believe – I walked through this thing, and I was like – because and also people are just smoking
this is
weed,
not like one
course,
guy
right
with,
out
like,
the open.
Like with the overcoat who's gonna sell you watches like you know sort of typically saying hey I have mushrooms for $20. It's like he's one of the fucking vendors practically.
There was a guy walking around and he had a sign that he was holding and it said LSD.
What the fuck?
You mean you're walking around like is this real?
Right. Yeah.
A guy walked up to me three separate times when I passed by him. And each time he looked at me and he goes, mushrooms and Molly. I got mushrooms and Molly. Like just audibly.
Right.
For anyone around him to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm I asked my buddy, I'm like, so this is at every show? And he's like, yeah, this is the scene. This is the Grateful Dead scene. And there's unauthorized Grateful Dead shit all over the place.
Right. I was going to say none of the t-shirts and stuff are for the band, right?
No, and yeah. I don't even know if these vendors, like, I tried to get an answer and no one could answer me. I'm like, so could I just set up a tent?
Yeah, can I see your license, your business license to operate in the state of Texas?
Yeah,
like,
can
oh,
I
shit,
just
am
show
I in
up?
Texas? I didn't even know, brother. Yeah.
Yeah, damn. It's like, can I just show up and do this?
Yeah.
It really blew my mind.
Yeah.
Said
this is 2 o'clock in the afternoon. This is not like
this is 2 o'clock
an hour
in the
and
afternoon.
A half before the show. This is
no.
5, 6, 7 hours before
no.
the show.
There's a guy with a pizza oven making pizza. like it was and amazing art.
Yeah.
And here's what's crazy though. So I'm asking
my
friends.
Did you find any glass that was blown
oh,
by
oh my god are okay. you kidding me
what about this was there any of these tie-dye shirts
I bought one so here's what's crazy so I asked someone like so does the band doesn't care
right
that people do this. And someone told me, he goes, I've seen Bob Weir on stage in a parking lot t-shirt.
What a BAMF. That's so awesome. Some bootleg piece of shit shirt. That is amazing.
He's wearing it on stage.
Okay, why does Bob Weir sound so familiar? Obviously, Garcia was like the main guy.
Yeah.
Bob Weir, is he prolific? Does he do other shit in the industry? I don't know why I've seen this guy's name a bunch.
The Grateful Dead is why you would know him.
Okay.
So I don't know. I mean, he did sing a lot of Grateful Dead stuff.
Let's get this straight. I don't know hardly anything about him. Is it Jerry Garcia and the Who Cares? Like, it's all his songs, all stuff he kind of writes and they jammed out on?
No.
Or, I mean,
no,
it's
because
just purely jamming all the time. There's no.
The jam is so important.
Right.
Like, if the keyboard player dies,
right,
and he did, and you know, the other guy might have a totally different vibe,
right?
You know, and it's like,
so it's so unstructured. Is Bob Weir like, is he a multi instrumentalist? Is he one of the singers? Is he
he's a rhythm guitar player, uh-huh, and singer and songwriter?
Okay, huh?
And so the other crazy thing though is that you'll see people walking around with one finger in the air. And those are people who need a ticket. They're here. They're at the venue. They got themselves here.
Okay.
But now they don't have a ticket. And they're looking. They need a free ticket.
Okay.
They're not buying a ticket from you. You are giving them a ticket.
Whoa.
And my friend is like, I said, so will they be successful? And he goes, oh, yeah, everyone will get in.
What?
Yeah. People will give them tickets. People will give. If you show up to a Dead show and you cannot, and you don't have a ticket, and man, you don't have any money, you can get a ticket.
Okay, just put on the tie dye.
Yeah, there's a guy.
Is the peace symbol necklace like absolute
oh my
must?
God.
Or
yeah, yeah. Okay. And there's a guy who has like an electric guitar and like a little battery powered amp, and he's wearing like super ratty clothes, you know,
right?
And he's playing the guitar. And my friend said, he said, I see him at a lot of shows. And I said, so what does he do? How does he afford to do this?
Right.
And he goes, he doesn't. He doesn't have a job. Like, this is all he does. Like, he will get a ride. Someone will give him a ride to the next show.
Whatever. He's a trustafarian man. Has to be.
What does that mean?
Trustafarian is a trust fund baby. Who's you know, all like into like hippie culture and how easy life is and how,
okay,
come on, man, like you don't have to work that hard, blah, blah, blah. And it's like the kid has, you know, a multi-million-dollar stipend a year just coming into
right,
his pocketbook, right?
Right.
But anyway.
I believe a lot of these people are not trust fund babies.
Oh, man.
There appears to be a lot of people who don't do any. A lot of these vendors, like, this is all they do. And you look at what they're selling, and you're like, there's no way they're making enough money to make any kind of a living. But it doesn't matter. They live in their van.
Yeah, and they just go to the
next
show.
I mean, they live in their van, and they just go to the next show. And like one of the guys I was with, he traded a ticket to the next show in Atlanta for a piece of art from one of the vendors. he saw something he liked, and he was
real, man.
Yeah, he's like, he saw something he liked, and he was like, how much is that? And she's like, either like $50 or a ticket to the next show. And he had an extra ticket to the next show, and he was like, all yours. Here you go.
Man.
Transferred it on his Ticketmaster app.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're no longer, I'm surprised Ticketmaster is even, you know, hooking up with Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's wild.
You said it's a farewell tour or something? I mean, these guys obviously are super old. Have they been gigging on and off still, like, for years and years and years?
Yeah.
Well, have they had, like, five-year periods? Obviously, like, COVID knocked everybody out for a couple of years, but...
No, so here's how they got to where they are now.
Okay.
They go through this thing in the... and like we were talking about in that board meeting,
right,
10 minutes ago.
Yeah, yeah.
They're getting, like, in trouble with venues. The crowd is turning a little bit dark.
This is late 70s, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it's turning into like they're attracting like a biker crowd for some reason.
Right. So meth
and
is coming around, that kind of shit.
Yeah, it's starting to feel a little dangerous. Yeah. And my friends who are Deadheads said like the scene got bad.
Yeah.
Like it was not fun for a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Jerry Garcia's health gets pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
He goes into like a diabetic coma in the mid 80s.
Oh my God.
He had been using heroin some, on and off, on and off for years. They, in 1987, like inexplicably, they have like a major radio hit for the first time ever. Like, the song Touch of Grey.
Okay.
Which is like a top 10. It's their first song that's come anywhere near that level of the charts.
Yes. Yeah, so my ex-wife had one, Grateful Dead record. It was that one. That one is like, is it called In the Dark or something? Is the,
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, and, this is pretty good. And, you know, then my dad played me American Beauty, and I listened to it two or three times, and I never remember a single song off of it, which, I don't know, maybe that's a testament to the vibe of it rather than the, you know, attachment to it. But anyway,
So, in the,
so they have this hit in 87.
Yeah, okay, and in 87 they have this hit. It's weird because now their crowds just explode. I mean, they're out of control.
Even because more than now, they were in the 60s and 70s.
Yes, because now you have people who don't know any songs other than Touch of Grey that they heard on the
and
radio.
And they're discovering this whole, like, subculture.
Yeah, so they come to a Dead show.
And their trust fund from the all of the 80s, like, loan and savings crisis stuff is coming to fruition. It's time to fucking hit the road. Okay.
And by the way, the Touch of Grey, this song that half the crowd has showed up to hear, they don't play it like hardly ever.
Right.
Like,
right.
they throw it into the set list every now and then, but they never play it. Because their set lists are different every night. Oddly enough, they played it the night I saw them.
Man, are these guys, are they going to the East Coast or are they coming my way? This is pretty wild. I might go see this.
Okay, let's look it up after after we're done here.
Okay.
They have this major hit. Their crowds are really exploding now. Now their pressures to tour are even greater because the demand is just that much higher.
Right.
Jerry is still using heroin on and off through the early 90s.
Okay.
And
now on and off, is this the Tom Petty situation we talked about in one of our recent episodes where it's like, you know, goodbye Jerry for 6 months and then he's good? Or is it like just kind of... You know, every tour, there's a couple of dates where Jerry's having a hard time.
No, I think it would kind of get bad, and then he would clean himself up, and he'd be good for a while, and then it would get bad again, and then he'd clean himself up.
Yeah, okay.
And that was kind of the cycle that he was in for a little while, it sounds like.
Okay.
And so the 1995 tour ends, and he goes to rehab, and he died in rehab, basically.
Damn.
Died of a heart attack.
Yeah.
But I don't know. My friend, the Deadhead friend, said she really thinks he just, like, they didn't wean him off of his drugs well.
Oh, okay. And, you know, and like, withdraw his heart on the healthy body.
Yeah.
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 Damn. Yep.
And he died. Now, this was really bad, and Bob Weir talked about this, that Jerry... One of the problems with touring and why they didn't feel they could stop is because people had started to see Jerry literally as like a messiah type figure. Like, people worshiped that man. And the Deadheads literally saw him as like a godlike
figure. Is this a philosophical kind of dude?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And if you see interviews with him, like, he is extremely likable.
Okay.
He is extremely well read.
Okay.
He's a smart guy.
Very eloquent.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Interesting. I don't know. For some reason, I obviously not being familiar at all, I always thought he was like one of those quiet, more, you know, keeps to himself kind of people. And I do not know why I had that impression. Maybe it's because he seems like he's happy. And I can't imagine anybody who interacts with the press, you know, being that way. But
yeah, I don't know. I don't know what drove him to it.
Yeah.
I don't know what, you know, who knows what drives anyone to do it or
listen,
not.
Listen, he's done enough acid for, you know, several lifetimes. You're going to get some philosophy along the way, right?
Yeah, I guess so. But he died. And Bob Weir said, like, Jerry, like, it was, like, for him, Bob Weir said, he goes, when I'm on tour, it's hard for me to walk down the street and not get recognized.
Yeah.
He goes, it was impossible for Jerry to walk down the street.
Right. Very recognizable.
He could not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just anywhere, you know? And there was a lot of pressure to just keep going. And so a lot of people were kind of questioning the Dead and, you know, why didn't you guys take a break? You know, Jerry needed to get healthy. Why didn't you just stop touring for a little while?
Uh-huh.
Because clearly the pressure of that is what got to him. And
but I mean, is this his ninth time in fucking rehab? I mean, you know,
I don't know how many times he'd gone to rehab.
You know what I mean?
But
it just sounds like it's part of the life. Okay, Jerry's down for a little bit again. We'll be back, you know, next summer, right?
But what would happen is when the Dead was on break from tour,
yeah,
Jerry would go tour with the Jerry Garcia band. And, you know, it was just him and, you know, a few other guys who had their own kind of non-Grateful Dead thing that he would do on the side.
Okay.
And so, and Bob Weir said, like, if we would have taken a break.
He wouldn't.
He just would have gone and toured with the Jerry Garcia band.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have mattered.
Man, you need to go see Primus or any of the side projects. This is sounding exactly like them. Where it's like really? This guy that just, he's just always on the road. He's having a good time. He's not, you know, and as far as I can tell, like, I mean, maybe he drinks a little bit, but he just, you know, music is life to this dude. Okay.
So Jerry dies and they, in the late 90s, they play a couple of shows with, I don't remember who they, I think they call it like Dead and Friends or something like that.
Yeah.
The other ones, they play a couple of quote, like farewell shows at Chicago Stadium.
Okay.
With, Trey Anastasio of Fish.
Really?
Kind of in Jerry's place.
That's really, that seems like a, wait for it, fish out of water kind of situation. Right.
Okay. Pull the plug on this episode right now. You know, so they do that.
Yeah.
Okay. In this time, right around this time that they're doing these quote farewell shows, and it's basically the rest of the guys from the Dead with Trey Anastasio.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's kind of a
cool
thing.
And obviously by this time, Fish was already a thing, right?
Oh, yeah. Trey Anastasio was well known, and they're a big jam band, too.
Yeah,
so
exactly,
everyone thought
right?
It was a pretty good fit.
Okay.
And
but
so,
they're like, okay, well, here we go. Garcia's gone. We're going to, you know,
yeah,
we're gonna see everybody off. So everybody, you know, gets their,
well,
their farewell, right?
I don't know when they started rethinking things. It may have been when they immediately sold out like three straight nights at Chicago Soldier Field.
Right.
Like
half a million people want to see him or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they added a few more shows at the football stadium in San Francisco.
Right.
And so, and then an interesting thing happens around this time. John Mayer, who, I don't know how much you know about John Mayer.
I know he's got Your Body's a Wonderland, right? That dude?
Yeah. Despite that, he is a master guitar player.
Right. I've heard that. Yeah, yeah.
Like, he is amazing.
Okay.
And he's a real student of music.
Okay.
Like, he is, like, he really, he knows his stuff.
Okay.
Why he makes such bad music, I don't know. It's a mystery that may never be solved.
I am seeing some overlap intersection with Grateful Dead, but okay, go on.
Okay.
Go on.
So he hears the song somewhere just on his iPod shuffle or something. He hears the Grateful, literally hears the Grateful Dead song Althea.
Okay.
And he just loves it. Like he falls in love with that song.
Okay.
And is like, okay, I got to learn everything I can about this band. And he just totally turns into a huge Deadhead and learns every Dead song he can. And he was guest hosting Jimmy Kimmel Live or something like that. Bob Weir is like a guest and they decide to play together
okay.
on the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they play a song or something. And so Bob Weir's like, so what if you come out on tour with us? And we'll call it Dead and Company.
Okay.
And John Mayer's like, yeah, I'm in.
Right.
And so like 2 months after these big farewell shows, they announce like a 30 city tour.
Okay.
As Dead and Company with John Mayer now in the place of Jerry Garcia.
Okay.
And I think for me, I remember when that happened and I like scratched my head. Like,
right.
Huh.
It's like
weird.
To me that smacks of the Queen situation, right? Where Queen got a young singer recently. And you're like, okay, I mean,
right.
They're gonna play Queen songs, right? They got somebody. Does John Mayer does he do a good Garcia impression? Is it that kind of a thing?
He doesn't. He does not sound like Jerry at all.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually went back and watched.
I guess that's kind of the nature of the freedom of this band, though, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's not supposed to be perfect.
Yeah.
But I went back, and it's on YouTube. His Mayer's first show with them,
right?
And it is amazing because, first of all, remember Jerry Garcia died in 1995,
right?
So there hasn't been like a real full on dead tour since then, of any major scale.
Sure.
And so now this is 2015. Okay. So this is what, 30 years later?
Yeah. 20, right?
20, 95, 2005. Yeah. Okay. 20.
Okay.
20.
So there had so, all that time, literally they'd like not even done little, you know, eight show tours.
Not a tour. There's been like one-off shows here and there.
Interesting. But man, when you were telling about this a few weeks ago, I was like, dude, has it been 60 fucking years these guys are nonstop doing that?
No. Oh, okay. So from 95 to 2005, there wasn't, or 2015, there was not like a big, you know, Dead tour.
Okay.
So Dead and Company do this tour. It is amazing because now it's been 20 years.
Yeah.
And when I saw the scene that I saw, I mean, you see how dedicated these people are.
Right.
And my first thought was, oh my God, how did these people go that many years and not do this?
Right.
Like, what did they do for those 20 years?
Yeah, right.
And it's incredible because when Mayer, so Bob Weir sings the first song and then Mayer sings the second one. And man, as soon as he hits his first note, like the crowd erupts and like they're into it. And it very much sounds like a thank you, John Mayer. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we're back. We're fucking back.
Right, right.
And, man,
okay, so the John Mayer, for me, I have that tagged as, like, 2009 or 10. There was some guy I worked with who used to make fun of that Wonderland song all the time.
Yes.
So is he done by 2015 and like becomes a part of this band permanently? Is this a one-off tour? What's the?
No, he's like Dead and Company has been touring basically nonstop since 2015.
With him or without him?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, with him.
It's not a rotating cast of guest people instead. It's,
no. He's been a part of the Dead.
So John Mayer is synonymous with Grateful Dead. Like he's a huge chunk of their history.
And he has said that he would do it forever. He loves it. He said it is his favorite thing that he does.
Huh.
Absolutely loves it. And man, the crowd loves him. He's a great guitar player. He's a great improviser. So for their jams, I mean, he can jam. I mean, he's great. He can really jam.
Yeah, it feels like Kenny Wayne Shepherd, I feel like, right? Late 90s was the one I had heard of who was like, you know, the Stevie Ray Vaughan level savant guy. Mm-hmm. And then John Mayer was the next one I heard of, which was a decade later. So I'm not surprised. Would you listen, maybe it sounds easier than it is, but like it doesn't seem like it doesn't seem super technical. It doesn't seem like it's you know, over the top crazy virtuoso kind of music. John Mayer, is he bored up there? Are these guys actually like really they are over the top musicians, or is it like jazz, or they kind of have to be because they're improvising all the time?
They have to be excellent musicians.
Okay.
It's not a set list.
It's not, you know, the song moves this way and then that way. It's
so they do have a set list, but Here's the thing. It'll be like when I saw them, like there's a song they played called Playing in the Band.
Sure.
And then that song, they go directly, they don't finish that song, but they go like directly into another song.
Right.
And then they go directly from that song into All Along the Watchtower, which is awesome.
A little salsa random stuff mixed
together. And then they jam out to All on the Watchtower for like a long time. And then they come back and they go boom right back into finishing Playing in the Band.
Yeah.
And when they went back into Playing in the Band, I was like, that was like an hour ago.
Man. Pearl Jam these days, and I think Primus too, you can get the bootleg a couple days later, like from the soundboard. Do these guys have that? Do you have that?
Yeah, I want to hear this. Yeah, Nugs. You can go to Nugs.
Okay. I got to hear this. That's cool.
It's incredible. And every show. Yeah, you can get every show.
Okay.
there is no shortage of material on this band. here's something I found that was just one of the most fun things I watched while I was like trying to learn all I could about the Dead. There's a song that I really like on American Beauty called Box of Rain. And I read that they didn't play Box of Rain from 1972 until 1986. It never made it into the set list, not one time. And they, to the shock of the audience, they played it in like, you know, Hartford or something one night in 1986. So I go on YouTube and it's there, of course.
A 1986 video bootleg.
Yes, yes. Of a specific show on a tour that probably had 100 shows.
Yeah. So like Nine Inch Nails, 1991, 5 years later, right? They're going on their first tour, the Pretty Hate Machine. And granted, they're not a huge fucking following or not whatnot, but there are two or three video bootlegs, period, that are really shitty, like really, really shitty quality. Just happen to be, you know, some venue just had a setup that they did that, you know. That's nuts, man. I mean, nowadays you're like, oh yeah, I want to see this Cure show, like it's coming in a few days. I can go see like, you know, the entire set pro shot in Buenos Aires 2 weeks ago, and then the festival in the UK 4 weeks ago, you know, but from the 80s, that's crazy. I mean, obviously there's 70s is even more rare, but man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so,
like you said, like a specific show too, just randomly. Yeah.
So what's funny is they start playing the song and when he sings the first note, the crowd goes insane, like absolutely insane. And the Phil Lesh, the bass player, sings it. He sings very few songs. And so he rarely sings anyway. And like, he's laughing because the crowd is going so crazy.
The song hasn't been played in 14 years. It's like
14. And the crowd, this is what's crazy.
It's not one of the three that was on the radio. It was like a deep cut.
The crowd knows this song hasn't been played in 14 years.
Yeah, right. Man.
This is 19. There was no setlist.fm.
Yeah, right. Right.
How did they even know?
Man.
How do you know what songs have and have not been played on this tour in 1986?
Listen, when you're a Trustafarian from the big oil times, you got a lot of time on your hands, Jeremy. A lot of time.
Okay, what's amazing about that is when you look at the comments on that YouTube video, people talk. It's like a Where Were You When Kennedy Was Shot. People literally, one guy commented, I was there. I literally ran to a payphone as fast as I could to spread the word that they played Box of Rain.
What a surreal, like, alternate history world. What is...
It's insane.
So strange, man.
Yes.
So, okay, all right. So this documentary you watched that was the same name as the book, does it talk a lot about the Deadhead like culture stuff, or is there another documentary about this? Or
no, it goes very deep into. People have their kids there.
Yeah.
Like traveling with them in vans,
like they give birth.
from conception to birth to graduation. So, you know, it's that scene. So like I go to the show, and there's a couple of things that struck me about the show itself. Number one, the crowd I've never seen a crowd like just dance. Like they're all just moving.
Yeah. Yeah. You sent me a video and it's like, it's all these people who are like boomers who, I don't know about you, but every concert I've ever been to in Dallas, I've never seen anybody moving. And secondarily, if there's any boomers, for God's sakes, they're definitely not moving, right? They're arms crossed at best, you know.
Right. There was one guy walking around. He'd like lost his cell phone and he was looking for his friend. I bet that guy walked by us 10 times asking if we'd seen his friend in a red Texas Tech t-shirt. And I finally told our friends, I said, you know what? I don't think he came here with a friend. I said, I don't think there is a friend.
It was literally, he was asking for a certain illicit drug and you guys weren't on the up and up on it.
Right. So
you gotta hear that Texas Tech, bro.
Yeah. So what was also amazing was,
just to be clear for our listeners, Texas Tech is in what city, Jeremy?
Lubbock, Texas.
Which, if you Google that one, one of the very first things that'll come up is something about drugs and drug capital of Texas or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, so there may be a meth problem. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Right, right.
So what's also got me about it was the reaction of the crowd to every song, because every song is such a surprise, and every song is one that they probably haven't played in several shows at least, but maybe even longer.
Now, have they been like, going since 2015 or?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
And by so, going, I mean, we don't mean like, we're not talking about like the, let's talk about like Metallica. Metallica might do a world tour and it is 3 years long, but they're, you know, taking 6 months at a time off. Like these guys are just leg after leg after leg with maybe a couple months a year off forever.
Yeah, more or less. John Mayer has his own tour schedule, so sure. They may take longer breaks with him than they would have previously with Jerry.
Sure.
But it's
100 plus shows a year nonstop.
I think it's about 80.
Okay.
80 shows a year. Which is still a lot.
That's a lot, yeah.
Yeah, it's still a lot. Yeah. So the music and the reaction of the crowd to every song was just like the sheer enthusiasm of it is what's incredible. It's such a grab bag.
Yeah.
And you don't know. So like when they played Touch of Grey was the encore.
Uh-huh.
And when you hear the first notes of it and you're like, they're playing Touch of Grey? And the crowd was like audibly shocked. They like, that's the song they play the least.
Right.
And my friend, she said she's been seeing them for 30 years. Uh-huh. She said she has seen them more than 80 times and she has never seen them play that song.
Damn.
Like the crowd.
Yeah.
And now a lot of Deadheads hate that song.
Okay.
Yeah. A little too mainstream for them.
Sure.
But yeah, the crowd was absolutely shocked that they played that.
That's nuts, man.
It doesn't sound like it sounds on the record. It's really slowed down. There's a lot more solos involved.
That was one of the things I wanted to ask you. What is this jam? Like, is it that they all go take a break and, you know, go to the bar for a minute and one guy is just noodling for 10 minutes?
No,
or,
no, mean, no. They're all in it. So, you know, Mayer will take a solo and, you know, they'll just play behind him.
Right.
But then he might throw it into another key. And now we're going to do this.
In the middle of his solo, he'll flip over and they all just follow and go with it.
They all have to go with him. And so that's why they have to be
like jazz, like free form.
They have to be like master musicians.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he'll hit it over to the bass player. Now the bass player takes his solo.
Doom, 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 doom. And like you said, they eventually come back from all along the watchtower to like.
And then, yeah, and then they'll do that. And then we get it over to the piano player, keyboard player. He does his thing. And then boom, back to Bob Weir, kicks back into the vocals, and we finish the song.
Damn, that's weird. And, okay.
But these songs can stretch on for 10 or 20 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is the other funny thing that happened was they have this thing called space drums.
Okay.
In every show.
Okay.
And they've done it since like the 70s. And this is where there is a drum solo followed by noise. And there's a guy up on, it's like the percussionist or the keyboard player is up there, like with this weird device. I don't know what it is. I saw strings. I might have seen a keyboard. I'm not sure. And it's just like ambient noise.
Is it like a theremin or whatever? That thing where you can move your hand and, you know, it's like a.
Maybe.
You know, a theremin's like, it's like this bar that's up and then it has a right angle, you know, triangle. And you can put your hand in it and it, like, depending on where your hand is, it's like registering it with, I don't know, infrared light or some kind of shit and you can tell.
It may have been something like that. I don't know what it was, but it produced, my friend is
this the intermission when this guy's doing?
No, this is not intermission. This is like after intermission. Okay. This is like during the show.
Okay.
So this is the one time where everyone does leave the stage for this ambient noise.
Okay.
Except for the guy doing the ambient noise.
And this happens every time.
Every show. And so my friends, their husband and wife, like the wife is the Deadhead, loves it. But says, like, if I'm at a show and I want to meet a friend, like, I'll do it during this.
Yeah, right.
You know, if I want to go, hey, let's meet over by the, you know, beer stand.
Yeah, much to the chagrin of our this guy who's doing this every day.
Right. And so There, but her husband said, this is an absolute waste of 20 minutes.
Right.
Yeah. He's like, we could all be going home right now.
Right, exactly. Like, 100%. Like, yeah.
But it's a thing, and people vibe to it. People just, you know, close their eyes and just get into it.
Yeah.
And then the band comes, and they finish whatever song started before Space Drums, and play a couple of more, and show's over. Show's over, you go back outside now.
Okay.
Shakedown Street is a real party now.
Really?
Now, there's big lights set up. And like it is, there's I ate the best hot dog I've eaten in my life.
Right.
On Shakedown Street. I mean, it was wrapped in bacon, had onions on it. Oh my God. It was incredible.
Okay.
And
then party just goes on through the night until people will wrap it up and start deadheading.
Yes. People
to the
are partying.
Place.
And half of those people were packing up and going, probably more than half of those vendors were packing up and going to Atlanta.
Man.
Some of the friends that were kind of with the people that I was with, they were like literally getting in their car that night, getting on the road to Atlanta for the next show.
Damn.
And like that, like they're going to as many shows as they can.
And again, this has been going pretty much nonstop. Maybe COVID stopped them for a minute, but I mean... That's crazy, dude.
Right.
I mean, there's a time in my life where that was something that was much more possible, you know, to just do that. And I followed some bands. I'd feel like a little bit of a sucker because the bands definitely had the exact same set list from night to night. You know, every single night was the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But man.
Yeah. This is, I mean, what happens
it's a
now?
It's a lifestyle, you know, I mean, it's,
yeah. So what happens now is like I look at the set list after every show and I'm like, oh damn it! like man, that would have been awesome.
Okay,
let's
roll back. Like you've been a Grateful Dead fan for a week or a few months or a few weeks.
I mean,
like, did you know American Beauty? Like you know these records?
No, I've been a big fan of American Beauty for a couple of years.
Oh, okay, all right.
But I never dove far beyond that. Oh, I never dove into the live into the live performances because if you listen to them on Spotify, sometimes it does sound like they're just kind of noodling around.
Sure. But
and
when you're
there,
it's a great experience.
Oh, that's what I told my friend. I said, you know, like, I'm into this. Like, this is awesome, and I'm really into it. But if I were listening to this in my car right now, I would have turned it.
Yeah, it's a cultural experience, right? It's like being in part of the herd that's experiencing it all at once, I got to imagine, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Huh.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it is truly a lifestyle, one that I have happily embraced.
Yeah.
not just the dead, but like jam bands. So like I went and saw Billy Strings last night. Billy Strings has a very Deadhead like fan base. In fact, like most of his fan base is also huge Grateful Dead fans.
Okay. Interesting.
And he does the same thing every single show. Is
what did you call it? The Space Drums?
Yeah.
There's our 20 minutes of the middle of the set Space Drums.
But it is like he doesn't repeat songs show to show.
Okay.
Every set list is completely different.
Man.
Every song is a jam, and it'll be they start the song. Boom, kick it over to the mandolin player. Mandolin player jams for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Boom, kick it over to the banjo player. Banjo player vibes. He does his thing. Kick it over to the fiddle player. He does his thing. Back to Billy. Finish up the song.
Okay, now listen.
And
I think that I'm probably going to not have to flash my white person ID ever again after the statement, but I had some live Dave Matthews Band records as a kid. And I think I know what you're talking about from that to some degree in a very, very pop, you know, rhythm focused way. They definitely had a little bit of this where it would be they're making these songs go a little bit out for a little bit. And like you said, like giving each guy almost like a chance to lead. Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I've never listened to Dave Matthews.
Very obvious. Is Dave Matthews loosely jam band? No,
I don't know. I was just about to say I've really never listened to live Dave Matthews.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I have no idea. The comparables here are a band like Fish.
Yep.
And I don't know. My friends who are Deadheads are not big Fish fans.
Yeah, I struggle to find anybody who's ever been a Fish fan. It seems like the Nickelback of jam bands. Like it's not cool to like them. I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, they have fans.
Right,
they have a lot.
Yeah.
And I like Trey Anastasio.
Here's the deal. 20-year hiatus of the Dead.
Mm.
That's it. That's got to be it.
There was a vacuum.
There's a vacuum, Nickelback of the Dead is still better than nothing, right? Maybe that's it.
I don't know if I would agree with Nickelback of the Dead. I don't want to besmirch our Fish fans out there.
Okay.
Fair enough. Widespread Panic is another one.
Really? Okay.
That is a big jam band. Okay. And I've seen Widespread Panic, and it is like every song is like 10 or 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And they all jam, and everyone loves it because, again, even if the Dead play Truckin', which you've heard on the radio 1,000 times, uh-huh. you have no idea what this Truckin' is going to sound like.
Exactly.
You know, it's the basic structure is going to be there.
Right.
But what are they going to do when they improvise?
Right.
It's going to be different.
Huh.
And
well, the other one I'll throw in there, I've mentioned it a couple times already, is the Primus guy, Les Claypool.
Yeah.
Any of his projects except for Primus. Primus is pretty much pop sort of psych rock, you know, mm-hmm. but very pop structured in general. It definitely has over the years gotten more jammy and spacey and stuff. But any of his side projects, Oysterhead, the Lennon Claypool conspiracy, where he's like in a
delirium,
right, where he's in a jam band with John Lennon's kid.
Yeah, Sean.
And then, right now he's on tour with one called the Frog Brigade, where they, in the middle of the set, cover the entire Animals record front to back by Pink Floyd, and they're also a jam band like the whole time. Man, so
that'd be awesome.
Yeah. we might have to look up that, see if you and I can figure out how to get to that. But I don't know because I'm not a huge, you know, Grateful Dead person, and you know my knowledge of Primus even is limited. But it seems like every side project that dude does are these, you know. These records that come out that are every single there, it's a full CD 80-minute thing, and it's got like 7 tracks on it, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and there's something about that I get right. it now, but you again, you have to really be willing to just kind of surrender yourself to the music,
exactly, and like have a minute to just chill. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You know, rather than I'm driving to get the groceries, I'm going to throw on a pop song real quick, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. So, cool. I'm a fan. I get it.
Okay.
And I'm a proud Deadhead.
So where are you now? Obviously, you went to Atlanta. What, are they working up the East Coast?
No. I went to Dallas. I didn't go to Atlanta. I really wanted to.
Okay. Are you going to catch them on the way back through when they come back?
I have one other possible date. I don't think I'm going to get there. But they're playing in Boulder in July. And I'm just trying to work that out.
Oh, okay. Big surprise. Okay.
Boulder's always been a big town for them. It really has been.
Interesting. So
they play at the football stadium. Man, we didn't even talk really much about the Wall of Sound, did we?
No, we didn't. And that's the one thing I remember.
Let's do that real quick.
Definitely. I got to pull up the Wikipedia on it because just reading the Wikipedia of it is fucking insane. But basically, they had this insane rig that had, like, for example, like 600 JBL speakers, and we're talking not like something that fits on your bookshelf, we're talking about 12 inch subs, you know 10 inch tweeters, and just 600 of them. This thing was so impractical that they can only use it for about a year because it costed so much money to sort of set it up and to you know, to cart it around. Like, it talked about, like, I guess it's in the 70s. So maybe was the gas crisis 73, 74? Because it was talking about specifically the amount of energy money to move it was out of control.
It was a little, the gas crisis was a little bit after that, but oil prices may have been high at the time.
Exactly. Right.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
And it sounded like, it was a lot. See, the problem, I mean, they were one of the first bands to play stadiums.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And
I
so
mean, yeah,
no
73
one, no
is
one,
like, I mean, you're getting into Zeppelin and, you know, I mean, yeah.
So
I mean,
nobody
Dark
knew
Side
how to do it.
Just then coming out. So they're only barely starting to do stadiums, right? I mean,
but they had like some like Phil Lesh, the bass player. And then they had some sound people that like they had it figured out.
Right.
Like what height these speakers need to be at to hit the crowd at the exact right spot.
Right. They were drawing crowds of 100K or more at the time. It combined six independent sound systems using 11 separate channels. Vocals, lead guitar, rhythm guitar, piano, each had their own channels and set of speakers. So literally like being close to the stage, right, where Garcia has his amp or a couple amps set up, this chunk of 200 speakers is just Garcia. You know what I mean? Like, no matter how close you are to the stage, it sounds like you're close to the stage. That is nuts.
I would just, what would you pay to have been able to hear?
I know, my dad went to this thing, and this is one of those things where I'm like, he plays me these records, and I'm like, I don't get it. And he's like, no, like, this setup was, and my dad literally got speakers that are called JBL L100 or something, and they were super, super popular, and now they cost like $1,000 a piece if you can find anybody who still has one. And that was, these were the speakers that they used, 500 of them. He was like, he described it to me, you know, over the years, over and over again. It was this wall of speakers. And you're like, I mean, come on. Like, what is it? They've stacked them like 20 high or something. Let's see. 586 JBL speakers, 54 Electro Voice tweeters, powered by 48 600-watt amplifiers, generating a total of 28,000 watts of continuous power. It's nuts. It's worth looking up Wikipedia, Wall of Sound, Grateful Dead. It's got pictures. There are pictures out there. There have to be like a video at least of just what it looked like.
There's video of it. I remember they talked about this a lot in the Grateful Dead Behind the Music.
Okay.
So I'm sure that's on YouTube.
Okay.
And they talk about this. And the band abandoned it. And I would bet technology advanced pretty quickly in this area.
Right, exactly. It sounded like more conventional, which I think exactly what we're saying.
A couple of years later, I think they just had better technology that they didn't need that anymore.
Right, there's like there's a market. Right. I mean, these stadiums are like, okay, well, these two or three bands are bringing these rigs around,
But can you imagine, because, that the loud sound you hear in an arena now, those speakers are hanging really in front of the artists. Can you imagine playing in front of the wall of sound?
Right. Yeah.
Like that sound is just hitting them in the back.
Right. Yeah, I mean, how are they not deaf? You know how like you're in the crowd of a big concert and you can feel it in your chest and stuff. I mean, like,
yeah,
who was it? Is it Tom Morello? One of these guys has a quote on file about like letting yourself go, like falling backwards and just standing there and staying there.
No, that's that David Gilmour.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
David Gilmour. Yeah, he said the sound is so powerful
you can just
you can't fall back. You can't fall backwards,
man. Crazy,
you know, like that's I and how are they not deaf?
Right,
and they probably are, is the answer.
The Grateful Deaf.
So you know, that was really innovative though, because like when the Beatles played Shea Stadium, there was not a speaker company in the world that could have provided the power that they would need to make everyone hear their music.
So that's why it sounds like the crowd's just screaming like crazy. It was an unprecedented thing.
Because one company provided like a ton of like their most powerful speakers. And I think they set them up and like you could not hear them. And so the Beatles literally plugged into the Shea Stadium PA. That's what they played through.
Man.
Like, so it sounded terrible.
Yeah.
Just absolutely awful.
I never thought about that. That's crazy. Because I mean, you and I grew up with like all this shit was figured out 20 years before we, you know, even went to a concert. Crazy. Okay. Yeah. It looks like a, definitely that there are things in our lifetime where it's been like the wall of the video wall. Right, that comes around, and you're just like, man, this is an experience. I can't imagine. My dad, like, it's you know, probably top two, if not the most crazy, amazing concert experience ever. So,
it really is. I highly recommend. I think they are headed in your part of the world.
Okay.
Before that tour is over, highly, highly recommend
doing
it. I'm going to give you just one quick jam band tidbit.
Okay.
And it's a, would you have ever guessed this band was a jam band?
Okay.
At one point.
Okay, Stone Temple
do you
Pilots.
Take it, do you want to take a guess?
Yeah, Stone Temple Pilots.
No.
Okay, Metallica.
No.
Okay. Celine Dion.
That'd be awesome, but no.
I'm not going to guess Weezer because that's going to just make me sad if it was. No, I don't know who we got.
Journey.
Okay, I can see it.
Before Steve Perry joined, Journey was a jam band.
This is like Fleetwood Mac being, what were they, blues or whatever?
Yeah.
It's like, like fully realized musicianship. And then you add a couple of people and it's like, bam.
Like,
you
know, Journey's first lead singer was Greg Raleigh. And Greg Raleigh was the lead singer for Santana.
Uh-huh.
And he had this deep, soulful
voice. Santana not jam band-ish?
Very jam band-ish.
Yeah, okay. All right, fair enough.
And so Journey was made up of a couple of guys when Santana kind of broke up.
Right.
These guys, you know, minus Carlos Santana, formed Journey.
Huh. Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so Journey was like, they were a jam band, and they would go, their songs would go on for 20 minutes.
Right.
And it was all about, Greg Raleigh said, like, it was all about the jam. It was all about the solos.
Huh.
And that's what our shows were about. And they had like a loyal following.
Listen.
Like, but it was a small following and it didn't sell any records.
Are you telling me that there are 30-minute versions of Don't Stop Believin' out there?
No, absolutely not.
Well, that because is a goddamn crime against humanity. Because
They had no hits. They had no hits during this jam band period.
Yeah,
their first, you go listen to Journey's first song on their first record and you'll be like, this is Journey?
Interesting.
This is cool. This is awesome.
Yeah. Hey, like, Don't Knock, Don't Stop Believin', dude. Like, that song fucking rips. I don't know what it is, like, about all those kind of 80s, you know, love ballads and stuff. That song is, like, the fucking shit. I got a quote on file with Jane where I'm like, you know, there are people who, like, complain about, you know, the sound and the noise of, like, their neighbors. And, like, my neighbors are over here listening to Don't Stop Believing on repeat for 3 hours and be like, God, I can just, like, feel my land value going up and up and up. You know? I mean, dude, what a fucking banger.
My favorite Journey song is Wheel in the Sky.
Yeah. Yeah, dude,
that's a banger.
It's one of those. It's definitely one of those bands that, like, I didn't used to listen to a lot of that kind of stuff, and I guess it was probably Jane or somebody. I think one of her friends liked Foreigner a lot. And we're like, okay, whatever, we'll put on the greatest hits, and that leads right over to Journey Greatest Hits. And like, damn, that's them. That's them. That's them. It's definitely probably know the hits band.
Hang on, I have to interject something on an emergency basis.
Okay.
July 7th and July 8th.
Yes.
Year of Our Lord 2023.
Okay.
Dead and Company will be playing at the Gorge.
Oh, shit. Are we doing this?
I don't think I'll be there. No, I can't be there then.
Okay.
That's impossible for me.
Now, listen, back to...
But you go. White, you go
back
forward.
Back to my certified white person passport. Somebody mentioned to Jane that Dave Matthews plays there every year.
Yes.
Is True this story. Something that does happen regularly for the Dead, maybe?
This is their last one.
Oh, no.
Bob Weir, I believe, has said, like, this. He's getting old.
Yeah.
I mean, he's 75 years old.
Yeah.
So I would expect this to be their last one, and I'm going to expect you will be on the secondary market for tickets.
Yeah, no shit. Third.
But the Gorge, two nights at the Gorge.
That's crazy. My God.
I mean,
I don't think. Yeah,
if you don't try to go, I will be very upset with you.
Okay.
And I'll release all those episodes that we don't want anyone to hear.
All right, cool. Yeah, well, we'll see. I'm probably not gonna go to the Gorge for the Gorge is like a pain in the ass, unfortunately.
Is it?
Yeah, it's one of these things where it's like a very small town is nearby with like one hotel, I think, at the Gorge.
Oh, yeah.
And if you win, it's, you know, it's just like it's like Woodstock practically. There's like one little road that gets in there, and every show people just wind up camping out there after it, because like it'll be until the morning, and not like 2 in the morning, it'll be until daylight. People are still waiting in line to get the fuck out of there and get to the highway. Which I absolutely worth it for certain experiences. And I'm not doubting you or any of the millions of Deadhead fans out there. I don't know that for me personally, that's the one I'm gonna make that investment in.
I don't know, man.
I do want to see something in the gore just on my bucket list. Yeah, I don't know that the Dead is it, but I got a lot of regrets in this life. This might be one of them.
Yeah, I'd hate to see it be a regret.
Yeah,
and I know one surefire way to make sure it's not. So,
okay. All right, awesome. All right, guys, that's the Dead, or at least our take on it. Talk to y'all later.